You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Sydney Foreman. This is the WFHB local news for Wednesday, October 7th, 2020.
The struggle went on from there until she passed in 2014 due to the use of heroin.
Later in the program, you will hear from a town hall hosted by Hoosier Action for Indiana House District 62. That's coming up in today's feature report.
Monroe County Police will not tell me. And neither will IU Health Hospital.
Also coming up, there was an attempted suicide at the Monroe County Jail. WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforty will have more later in the program. But first, your local headlines.
With the pressing headlines you need to know today, we turn to WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforty, who filed today's local news brief.
From WFHB, this is a COVID-19 update for Wednesday, October 7th. I'm Aaron Comforty. 1,302 new cases of COVID-19 were reported in Indiana on Tuesday, according to the Indiana State Department of Health. That's slightly higher than the state's moving average. 17 new COVID-related deaths were added to the state's tally as well. Today, there are more than 1,000 Hoosiers hospitalized because of COVID-19. And locally, Monroe County saw 22 newly confirmed cases yesterday, which is exactly the county's moving average. Monroe County's numbers represent a significant drop in new cases since the middle of last month. Surrounding counties saw between 0 and 15 new cases. This morning, Indiana University reported about 2,900 positive COVID-19 test results since testing began in mid-August. The university's website does not state how many of those positive tests belong to unique individuals, so we don't know what the positivity among unique individuals is. That is one of the primary metrics that the federal government requires in COVID reporting. Positivity among unique individuals is almost always higher than positivity rates from all testing, which includes repeat testing of the same people. According to the university, for the past 4 weeks, however, positivity has been trending downward across all testing categories at Indiana University Bloomington.
Monroe County Councilwoman Kate Wilt proposed a permanent part-time worker raise during their October 6th budget hearing. She made the argument for permanent part-time workers to be paid a living wage.
So our permanent part-time positions are all right now listed as part-time hourly lines that are within each department. And each department sets the wage range, essentially. And since I'm probably one of the least experienced people on this meeting, anybody who wants to jump in and say, hey, Kate, you got that wrong, feel free. But my understanding then is that these lines all have kind of a base or minimum, and then each department has their own range up to a maximum. The minimum across all of the departments is the federal minimum wage.
Wiltz mentioned the importance of a range flexibility to accommodate multiple job positions. She proposed a permanent part-time minimum wage of $14 an hour. Wiltz included a proposed addition of a temporary account line with a different pay range to accommodate any exceptions.
And then add a temporary part-time account line to accommodate the hopefully very few necessary exceptions to this rule. For instance, if we have seasonal positions that just really don't fit into what a department head feels warrants this pay rate. I would hope that we could talk about those things, but we can have a different pay range for this temporary account line. And perhaps it goes from $9 up.
Wiltz mentioned the proposed raise would cause an about $50,000 increase to their budget. She said that was less than a 5% increase in the part-time lines. Councilmember Eric Spoonmore recommended including temporary and seasonal workers.
You know, I would like to be able to say that all Monroe County employees are earning a living wage, regardless of what their hourly status is or their full-time status is. I think that if Monroe County government has a job and we're paying somebody to do that, we owe them the dignity of paying them a living wage.
County Auditor Catherine Smith said the budget was proposed and advertised high enough to allow for the raise. Council members unanimously approved a part-time pay raise consideration to be heard during their October 13th meeting.
Bloomington Police Department reported its first positive COVID-19 test result. The test came back positive Tuesday after the individual began to experience symptoms on Saturday, October 3rd. According to a city press release, quote, "The employee, who is not a patrol officer, had minimal contact with the public during the 72 hours prior to the onset of symptoms," end quote. Following Centers for Disease Control guidelines, BPD is working to identify any coworkers with whom the employee may have been in contact with to prevent further transmission. The individual is on sick leave until fully recovered. This results in 11 reported positive test results from Bloomington city staff.
Monroe County Community Schools are opening to 5-day in-person learning on Monday. All grade levels will participate in in-person classes Monday through Friday. However, a virtual option is still available. This learning status falls into their phase green of the MCCSC reentry metrics. The reentry phase is determined by positivity rates, new cases per day, local test turnaround, and contact tracing. According to a Hoosier Times article, during the week of September 27th, there was one case identified at Bloomington High School North, two at Bloomington High School South, and one at Grandview Elementary. Since then, three more cases have been reported at Bloomington High School South. The MCCSC Metric Committee is scheduled to meet on October 27th to determine which phase schools will implement on November 2nd.
Up next, WFHB correspondent Jake Jacobson reports on the third public forum for the redevelopment of the current Indiana University Health Bloomington Hospital site, which took place last night on Zoom. We turn to Jake Jacobson for more.
Last night, the City of Bloomington hosted its third public forum discussing the future redevelopment of the current IU Health Hospital. The city bought the 24-acre site in 2018. While construction of the new IU Health campus was beginning off of State Road 46. IU Health will continue to use the space until moving into the new facilities in late 2021, according to IU Health's website. The discussion was held in conjunction with Skidmore, Owens, and Merrill, the Chicago-based urban planning firm hired to design what the current IU Health site will become. Deputy Mayor Mick Renison led the meeting with a recap of previous forum discussions.
We conducted our first public forum on June 16th. There were 200 participants in that forum on Zoom. That particular forum asked participants what they would like to see on the site as it redeveloped. So that was our starting point. The second public forum was held August 6th, over 100 in attendance at that forum. And that forum focused on economic conditions and early design options, reflecting on the feedback we received from Forum 1 and input from surveys that we conducted after Forum 1 was conducted. And now we are at Forum 3 tonight, where we will share the refined plan based on comments from those previous processes.
Consultants from Skidmore, Owens, and Merrill addressed several community concerns during last night's meeting. One of the main goals of the redevelopment project is downtown connectivity, creating an area that is, quote, complementary to downtown, but that is a way to bring a focus to this part of the city, end quote. Chris Merrill talked about how existing structures, such as the Beeline Trail and Building Trades Park, can help create connecting parks and plazas.
So within that east-west greenway, then, we're starting to imagine this framework of a gradient moving from west to east of plaza and garden spaces. The plaza spaces would be prioritized around mid-block crossings, at intersections and active building edges, They're more open for flexible programming, a little more urban, and might have more iconic water features or seating elements. Whereas the garden spaces bring you through the block and it's much more lush, brings some of the stormwater management through planting and the collection of water within the heart of the development. You can also see we've located one of these yellow plaza spaces at the terminus of Fairview and Second at Building Trades Park, as was mentioned in the first section, as a way to get from the development to Building Trades Park and into the development as well. And you can see with the core open space, also trying to connect diagonally so that you could move from Rogers and First Street through the core landscape into the Greenway. And then on the east side, also a new plaza that would broaden that beeline gateway that currently exists right at the corner of the Kroger there.
That'd be good.
Into the development side.
One of the bigger challenges that SOM have encountered is around vehicle access. Consultant Doug Voigt highlighted some roads that would be hard to extend through the site and some ways they plan to work around those issues.
One of the challenges we did have was the connection here and the extension of Jackson Street. That change in elevation is too significant to create a roadway through there, but it also allows us to create greater connectivity to the parking garage. And so one of the decisions we made in this refined plan was to look at the connectivity of the grid, but perhaps there do it in a way through the development block, knowing the some of the challenges just through the engineering of vehicular access.
Merrill briefly addressed concerns that vehicle access could undermine attempts at making the project environmentally sustainable. Merrill talked a bit about designing the space so that vehicles and pedestrians could both access the open space.
Again, layering in the street network is critical to how we think about connectivity and access to open space. I'll point your attention to the east-west greenway here as you start to see all the north-south streets turn from solid lines to dashed lines. And that's our way of trying to understand how the street could go from vehicular space to pedestrian space. And when you transition through that zone, you're feeling like you're crossing this east-west greenway that really prioritizes pedestrian space.
With last night's feedback, Skidmore, Owens, and Merrill will refine these plans to reflect the scale of the development. The refined master plan will be revealed at a fourth public forum scheduled for November 18th. The goal, according to Deputy Mayor Renison, is to create a plan that can adapt over the course of the multi-year, multi-faced redevelopment project. Community members can still give feedback and ask questions about the project online at bloomingtonhospitalsite.com or by contacting Project Manager Kelly Boatman by email or at 812-349-3406. For WFHB, I'm Jake Jacobson.
Some people may find this next story disturbing, and it may not be suitable for all listeners. There was an attempted suicide at the Monroe County Jail today. Correspondent Aaron Comforty spoke to Tina Montgomery, the mother of Alan Montgomery, who attempted to take his own life. We want to warn you again, the following interview may not be suitable for all listeners. If you or a loved one needs support, call the toll-free 24/7 National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. You can also text HOME to 741741 for free, which offers 24/7 support from the Crisis Text Line.
According to a Facebook thread that included a post from Monroe County Councilmember Jeff McKim, an inmate at the jail in downtown Bloomington named Alan Montgomery attempted to commit suicide yesterday and was subsequently brought to an IU health facility. I reached out to the Monroe County Correctional Center, and when I asked about the attempted suicide, an employee confirmed that an investigation is underway, but they would not confirm what the investigation is actually about. When I asked under what legal basis the jail could withhold that information, the employee said that he did not know. I met with Tina Montgomery, Alan's mother, on her front porch and asked her what she knows about her son's condition.
So I don't know nothing about my son. I don't know whether he's alive, whether he's dead. Monroe County Police will not tell me. And neither will IU Health Hospital.
And how did you hear about this whole thing to get started with?
A friend of mine was telling me that was in the cell block next to him that got released yesterday.
Gosh, and what did he tell you?
He just told me that my son hung himself yesterday morning. And he said he didn't look well. They was trying to revive him. Said he wasn't looking good. And that's all I know.
Okay. I'm so sorry to hear that.
Officer Market got rude with me this morning when I called at the Bloomington Police Department and told me he was not allowed to tell me anything at all. All he could tell me was my son got released. He couldn't tell me whether he was dead, whether he was in hospital, where he was at. I asked him if I needed to come down and collect his belongings, and he told me absolutely not, because they got released with my son. And I asked him, I said, where is my son? I can't tell you that because of the new HIPAA law that Trump passed.
Now, what was that officer's name?
Market is who I talked to this morning.
A Monroe County sheriff.
Monroe County jailer down here at Monroe County Jail.
Okay.
Corrections Department.
The lack of clear information coming from the jail is adding stress for Tina. She's very concerned about the well-being of her son.
That's my baby. That is my baby. And they won't tell me nothing. IU Health won't even tell me nothing.
Ms. Montgomery, thank you for speaking with me, and I'm sorry about everything that's happened to you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
It's very sad to hear Mrs. Montgomery's experience, but if reports of the attempted suicide are true, it would mark a continuation in a problem that some people say has plagued the jail in recent years. I spoke with local activist Mark Haggerty about what he says is a trend of recent suicides at the jail.
Since this sheriff was elected, Brad Swain, we've had the first suicides ever in the Monroe County Jail since the new jail was built many, many years ago. And we've had three suicides. And I'm not blaming it on the sheriff, but the prosecutor's department and the judges don't want to know about it. The judges will not allow anyone to come. They won't allow me to come and speak at their board of judges meeting and inquire about this. They canceled the recovery program in the jail. They got rid of it. It was our community-based recovery program, and they replaced it with a government program that the government gets to say who's in there. And that program represented a safe place to put younger people, those below 18 sometimes, and mentally ill, that we worried about having suicide issues. They could go down there in the recovery block, and those good men down there would take care of them and kind of nurture them, and we never had any of that kind of problem down there. And it was a gift to the jail too, under Sheriff Sharp and Sheriff Kennedy. But like I said, Sheriff Swain has abolished that program.
WFHB will continue to cover this developing story in the coming days. For WFHB, I'm Aaron Comforti.
Hoosier Action hosted a virtual town hall on Tuesday for the candidates running for Indiana House District 62. The town hall covered issues in rural communities and small towns. Topics at the event included healthcare, rural transportation, the opioid crisis, the coronavirus pandemic, and housing insecurity. Democratic candidate Alyssa Bailey runs against Republican incumbent Jeff Ellington in the upcoming election. Bailey was not present at the town hall meeting, but in a written opening statement, she said her campaign focuses on education, accessible and affordable health care, and developing the economy. In his introduction, incumbent Jeff Ellington talked about his experiences as a former Monroe County councilman that helped guide his platform as a state legislator.
My name's Jeff Ellington. I live on the south side of Bloomington. I am a current county councilman. I spent 8 years as a Monroe County council person. And I learned a lot as a county council person, basically dealing with all the local services that the county offers. I dealt closely with Community Kitchen when Julio Alonso was there, and then when he moved on to the food bank. I also worked a lot with Habitat for Humanity, and I was a career firefighter for the City of Bloomington for 28 years, where I retired in 2016 to focus my full efforts as your representative. My main goal, and I hope I've accomplished that as representative, was going into this position, was to make sure that I was available 7 days a week, even 24 hours a day, if you have an emergency.
House District 62 represents about 66,000 residents with about 26,500 households. Hoosier Action said the state is filled with small towns and rural communities who may not feel their voices are being heard at the State House. The town hall offered stories from district residents, an opportunity for Ellington to hear from his constituents in real time. One resident, Abigail Reamer, shared the story of her sister who died from an overdose.
Shortly after my nephew was born, Lauren stood up and quickly sat down in pain. She was in need of surgery. The woman who had birthed two children was put into check by a gallbladder that needed removed. My belief is this is the beginning of the end. The opioids sneak in their fabulous early 2000s ways they did to so many human beings. The struggle went on from there until she passed in 2014 due to the use of heroin. Myself and others often question what could have been done to change this. I'm here speaking to you today, 6 years after my baby sister's death, and my only hope is that I may prevent someone else from losing their best friend, as I have. I reflect often on what should have and could have been done differently. I reflect on the people I have met who have lost a sibling or a parent or a partner. Even today, my largest reluctance to speak publicly is the shame and embarrassment of who my sister became. As I write this, and I remember who she was, my baby sister was a genius. I refuse to allow her to be remembered as someone who got caught up in the opioid epidemic, the epidemic that should have never been allowed to happen. Punishing people and not allowing them access to resources with dignity does not work. We need to implement programs that help people. We need to remove the shame from those who struggle with substance use. We need more success stories of people overcoming their struggle than stories about losing the people we love. With that said, how do we fix it? What would keep others from feeling the pain my family has endured? How are you going to make sure that those who struggle with substance abuse are getting the resources they need?
Ellington responded by calling for more addiction and mental health services to tackle the opioid epidemic.
I'm really sorry for your loss. It's a hard thing to deal with someone who has an addiction problem. And, you know, the brother, sister of that sibling, or even the mother or father or uncle or grandparents, really, it's so hard for it, and it's same for me. It's so hard for me to try to figure out, you know, how I could have helped, say, for example, my brother, because he had drug-induced schizophrenia, and he ended up dying, you know, a few years into that. And I tried everything. You know, I would try to call the psychologist and psychiatrist and try to learn things in the mental health process. And it was just something, I just couldn't handle it. I wasn't smart enough. And I'm sure parents feel the same way about their child who has the same problem. But while I've been in the house, we've done several things. We've put more money towards drug addiction and treatment programs. We've put some clinics throughout the state and spread, I believe it was six of them throughout the state, all within an hour reach of every, and that's just the beginning. We signed a needle exchange program that was started out in the southern part of Indiana around New Albany, and now that has expanded. Some people don't agree with that, but others who have addicted family members think it was the right thing to do. And as I mentioned before, mental health really is the key, I believe, to addiction. And I would say across the nation, there is such a need for mental health services more than ever now, especially with COVID.
According to a study by the Indiana State Department of Health, in 2017, there were over 1,800 overdose deaths in Indiana. averaging 5 deaths a day. In that same year, Indiana had the 19th highest drug overdose death rate in the U.S. Another resident, Laura Pence, shared her experience in acquiring health insurance and posed a question to Ellington on the Affordable Care Act.
I'm the owner of a small creative agency here in District 62. Ever since I was like 23, I knew I wanted to have my own design business. But for years, I was unable to follow my dream because a pre-existing condition prevented me from getting my own health insurance policy. It wasn't that I couldn't afford health insurance. I just couldn't get it. Like, I tried repeatedly and actually received a lifetime denial of service from a major insurance company because of my condition, even though it was in remission. So when the Affordable Care Act happened, I was finally able to achieve my dream and open my own agency. Over the years, it has grown and expanded to provide work for other local artists too. But now I'm looking at the future of the ACA and I feel concerned about what will happen to my health insurance. Will the regulations that stop insurance companies from denying me coverage or dropping me or inflating the cost of my policy if I get sick again, will they be repealed? And then what will happen to my business?
Representative Ellington responded by calling for more transparent state healthcare legislation.
One issue would be, you know, the pre-existing conditions that was there before the new plan that took place 7 years ago. And then it changed, and then they still kept in there pre-existing conditions that they couldn't deny you for that. Now, on a state level, what I can tell you that we've accomplished is, one, we put transparency into the cost of procedures throughout all Indiana hospitals, which led just by us talking about that at a state level and passing it. And we've been talking about other things such as prescription drugs trying to be driven down. There was just a deal reached in Northeast Indiana just a few weeks ago with two major healthcare organizations who were in negotiations with other plans, purchasers, you know, city, towns, private pay, that they were able to reduce those plan costs by literally not millions of dollars, but tens of millions of dollars just from the state passing that transparency bill and letting the healthcare industry know that we're not after hospitals, our doctors, our prescription companies, but what we are after is affordable healthcare.
The election comes on the front of a budget year. That means in 2021, the Indiana General Assembly will vote on how the state will spend its $33 billion budget over the next 2 years. The town hall closed with a call to action for all District 62 residents to vote in the upcoming election. You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Aaron Comforti, Jake Jacobson, and Sydney Forney in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services.
Our features were produced by Aaron Comforti and Cade Young. Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Our executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Forman.
And I'm Benedict Jones. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio. Coming up next on WFHB.